From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, Angela Merkel and the Euro crisis, the rebels fighting in Syria, and trying to breathe in Beijing. In the midst of the financial crisis in Europe, the focus has been on German Chancellor Angela Merkel, probably the most powerful person in Europe right now. She's called the continent's debt problems Europe's biggest crisis since the Second World War. And as the leader of the most powerful European economy, she's the one both calling the shots and under most scrutiny. NPR's Eric Westervelt has this profile.
The German TV satire show Extra 3 has had its share of fun depicting Chancellor Merkel as a politically composed yet frumpy and ultimately empty leader.
Du bist die Frau mit null Ideen. Du machst auf coole Dinge.
You are the woman with zero ideas, the ripoff of Barry Manilow's Mandy says. You come across as calm and cool, not a bead of sweaty fear upon your head. You're really beginning to annoy us, the song says.
Und wir bezahlen das Buffet, oh, Angie.
The spoof, like all good satire, has a kernel of truth. Merkel's approach to the debt crisis has been calm, logical, methodical, too slow and unimaginative, according to detractors, especially outside of Germany. They're seething that she insists on austerity as the medicine for debt-ridden southern neighbors, while she offers no new ideas for growth and fiercely resists efforts to let the European Central Bank intervene more.
The German leadership has been jumped from crisis to crisis and too little too late, and her leadership, I think, has been very disappointing.
Economist Gail Allard with Madrid's IE Business School says this moment cries out for a bold, visionary approach, not Merkel's timidity. She says the chancellor should communicate to the German people how much their export-dependent economy has gained from the euro and how its banks are partly to blame for the crisis by aggressively lending to their southern neighbors.
I think there's maybe fear of telling the truth to German citizens that if the euro founders, it's going to hurt German industry badly. German industry has benefited hugely. And the slowdown right now in Germany is due to the crisis in so many of their export markets on the periphery of Europe.
But CDU politician Elmar Brok, a member of the European Parliament, says Merkel is using the crisis as an opportunity to reshape European fiscal policy more in tune with German post-war sensibilities of frugality, caution, and historical fear of inflation.
She wants to have a long-term solution, not a cheap way. And this is sometimes difficult in politics, which look for the next election date.
That cautious, methodical manner is rooted in Merkel's personality, as well as her political and personal background. She is a bit of an anomaly as leader of her Christian Democratic Union, a party deeply influenced by Catholic social teachings with its core support traditionally in Western Germany. By contrast, she's the daughter of a Protestant minister who grew up in the then communist east of the country and trained to be a physicist before entering politics. Merkel biographer Gerd Langut says her family had two cars and traveled relatively easily between East and West Germany, leading him to conclude that her pastor father had what he calls a sympathetic relationship with the communist dictatorship. He says little in her orderly upbringing suggests she's capable of truly courageous leadership.
She is not a dreamer. She is not a historian. She does not have big visions. She does not like to create big pictures of the future. She is a step-by-step decision maker.
Langut knows Merkel and finds the popular image of her as charismatically challenged and aloof unfair. She's a logical, unpretentious woman, he says, who still lives in the same apartment that she did before becoming chancellor with her husband, a chemist who hates media or public attention. Yet Langut says Merkel was not shaped by history the way her CDU predecessors, Konrad Adenauer and Helmut Kohl, were. Kohl, he notes, as chancellor would sprinkle his speeches with personal memories of hardship, of American aid in the rough years after the war. His late wife had been raped by the Red Army and thrown out a window as a preteen. Experience shaped Kohl's efforts to build a united Europe and a strong transatlantic relationship.
Helmut Kohl was much more European by heart. He knew what European unity means because he lived during the Second World War.
What Langgut says for Merkel, the European project is much more a rational, matter-of-fact decision. She was born in 1954, 9 years after the war, and learned about the conflict in school. It was an ideologically loaded communist curriculum, the biographer notes, which glorified so-called anti-fascist fighters, downplayed atrocities, and sidestepped the full historical picture.
It was not treated in the political and civic education in the same manner as in Western Germany. And of course, younger people do not feel personally responsible for the Second World War and for the Holocaust. So this experience never made Angela Merkel in her youth.
She is acutely aware of the European sensitivities toward a powerful, resurgent, economically dominant Germany, Langgut says, but adds she may not appreciate it the same way as her predecessors did. Merkel often says if the euro fails, so does Europe. But some wonder if she really feels the weight of history and her crucial role at this moment. As one biographer put it, in her years in power, Merkel has not made a single truly memorable speech. Yet that may not matter. A majority of Germans embrace their even-keeled chancellor. Her personal approval rating today remains near 60%, and more than half of her countrymen say they trust her to guide Europe out of the crisis. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Berlin.
Coming up, the rebels fighting in Syria and trying to breathe in Beijing. Pro-democracy protests in Syria and the government's brutal response to them is starting to look more and more like a civil war. Although the protests across the country still remain mostly peaceful, a shadowy group of defected soldiers has formed a force called the Free Syrian Army, and that's been launching attacks on government targets. NPR's Kelly McEvers crossed into Syria in secret and spent a night with the rebel army.
Yeah, so we're on this little dirt road. We're about to hop on the back of a motorcycle. We've been dropped off by one contact. Now we're going with another one. Two of us getting on the back of this bike. Yeah, it's cold, it's dark, and we are crossing the border.
The Free Syrian Army doesn't hold any territory. It's not like in Libya, where rebels fighting to bring down their dictator controlled a swath of the country. Instead, what the Syrian rebels have is a kind of underground railroad, a series of safe houses in Lebanon that lead to smuggling paths that lead to more safe houses inside Syria. The idea of this underground railroad is that guns, and sometimes reporters, can come into the country while wounded rebels can go out. Once we're inside Syria, we meet the rebels who handle this in-and-out traffic.
What happened there?
They put us in a car that looks like it's been through hell. Rebels point their guns out of windows that no longer exist. Lookouts positioned along the road give hand signals that it's safe to pass.
And we are driving on some sort of paved and unpaved roads, driving through mainly farms with three guys who have AK-47s. They are all, you know, wearing green khaki-type jackets and, you know, headscarves tied around their hair. They got beards. They're psyched. You know, they're clearly, like, pumped with adrenaline.
The rebels show us a spot where they say two bodies were dumped just a few days before. They say the dead men were soldiers, just like them, who'd refused orders to fire on protesters and who'd tried to defect from the army. Our final stop is a shack in the middle of an apple orchard.
It's a little tiny farmhouse, concrete floor, heater in the middle, you know, water bottles, clothes hanging all over the place. Clearly people sleep here, jeans, scarves.
The Free Syrian Army first emerged this summer when a defected colonel who claims to be their leader released a statement on YouTube. The group now says it has thousands of soldiers inside Syria and varying levels of support in neighboring countries like Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan. Last month, the group launched its most daring operation when it attacked the feared Air Force Intelligence Agency just outside Syria's capital. The farmhouse fills up with more men. The newcomers say they are captains in the Free Syrian Army. They say attacks like the Air Force Intelligence job are still rare, but they smile when we say the name Che Guevara. Captain Al-Ali says the group is hoping for international intervention, ideally a no-fly zone over Syria. Even though Syrian troops don't actually attack protesters from the air, he says a no-fly zone would encourage more soldiers and more officers to defect. If we have a no-fly zone, brags Captain al-Ali, the regime will fall within days. The question is, how? At the hands of this ragtag group of rebels, or would it be some kind of coup where high-ranking officers still inside the army force the Syrian president and his cronies to leave? The captains say they haven't thought that far ahead. Diplomats and analysts here in the region say a coup is the least violent option, especially as this conflict turns more bloody and more sectarian. The majority of the protesters and the Free Syrian Army are Sunnis. The regime is Alawite, a sect affiliated with Shiites. Back in the car and on our way out of Syria, the rebels talk about drinking the blood of those who've jailed and killed their friends. They show us where just the day before they shot at Alawite thugs known as Shabiha. The word literally means ghosts. "We'd love to stop and show you this land," one rebel says. "We'd love to turn on the lights and let you see how beautiful it is. But not until it's our land," he says. "Not until it's free." Kelly McEvers, NPR News.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. Concern is growing in Beijing about pollution caused by coal-fired power plants and vehicle emissions. For most of the last 2 months, the air pollution there has hit levels hazardous to human health. That's according to a monitoring system at the U.S. Embassy. The official Chinese statistics come from measuring only large particles, and they're widely seen as producing less reliable information. NPR's Beijing correspondent Louisa Lim has two small children, and in this postcard from the Chinese capital, she describes family life amid the pollution.
I've just got up. The first thing I do in the mornings is I look out the window to see how polluted it is. And today, I have to say, it's pretty disgusting. There's a kind of white haze which is hanging in the air. It's shrouding everything with mist. And I have an app which I normally check first thing in the morning. It's linked to the air pollution monitor at the US Embassy. Oh no, today is 325 on the air pollution index. That's officially hazardous to human health. This is going to be a big problem today. My six-year-old has a football match.
I want Cheerios.
Listen, you may not be able to go to your football today.
Why then?
Look how polluted it is outside.
Oh, I don't want my golden medal.
Listen, we'll check what the pollution level is before football, and if it's dangerous, then you can't go, okay?
That's a very super good idea. Put your pollution mask on, Mummy. No, put it on me and I'll play with it on.
Serious? You'll play with the face mask on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now it's afternoon and the air pollution index is over 400, so even sitting outside to watch the football seems foolhardy. So the kids are playing computer games at home instead of running around outside. All this time that they're spending inside is kind of making me wonder what it is they're breathing inside our apartment. So I think it's time to get the experts in.
I'm Chris, Chris Buckley. I have a business in Beijing selling air purifiers.
So you've brought this equipment with you.
It measures the number of particles in the air at different size ranges.
Should we find out how it is? Now I'm really scared of this figure.
Okay. So outside I was getting 314 micrograms, and indoors I've got 208 micrograms.
You're telling me that the level of air pollution inside is five times what the US EPA would consider average.
A safe average, yes. As we speak, we are both breathing air which the EPA would say was not good.
That's really scary.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, welcome to Beijing.
Well, to find out more about the long-term impact of pollution, I called Avraham Ebenstein from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Together with Chinese colleagues, he's been looking at the different life expectancy rates north and south of the Huai River. The government provides heating, mainly coal-powered heating, north of the river, but not south, making the pollution much worse. I want to know what they found.
It's actually kind of funny because the former premier of China was a southern resident, and he was concerned about moving to the north. And he said, if I moved to Beijing, I would lose 5 years of life expectancy, which is astoundingly close to the estimates that we observe. Our estimate is about 5 to 6 years of a foregone life expectancy over the long haul of living in Beijing relative to southern cities.
But hold on a minute. Your research was based on data from the 1980s. I mean, how relevant is that for us now?
The answer is we don't know. On the one hand, maybe the air pollution isn't as bad now as it was before, and those people lost 5 years. But since you're going to have a less of a chance of getting other kinds of illnesses, if you're exposed to air pollution now, as a relative share of the health cost to you, it could still be a really big factor. It could still have a really large impact of life expectancy.
So how to protect yourself from the very air that you breathe? We end up shuttling our kids by car from one indoor play place to another, minimizing their time outside. Until now, our strategy's been denial, pretending it wasn't really that bad. That's no longer an option. We don't know what living here will cost us in health terms, but the immediate cost to us of doing this story has been almost $3,000 in new air purifiers. An option that's out of reach for most Beijingers. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.